On July 16, the Wisconsin Supreme Court shut down a John Doe investigation of campaign finance spending and relationships between Governor Scott Walker's campaign to survive the 2012 recall and groups supporting the governor. Writing for the four-justice majority, Justice Michael Gableman said, "Let one point be clear, our conclusion today ends the unconstitutional John Doe. But what does the ruling mean for future John Doe probes, campaign finance laws, and the Government Accountability Board? To discuss these issues, thanks to my left, Donald Downs. He's a UW-Madison political science professor, president of the UW Center for the Study of Liberal Democracy. Mike Wittenweiler, an attorney with Godfrey & Kahn, who specializes in campaign finance issues. And Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Gentlemen, my first question, what, if anything, surprised you about that 388-page ruling, which includes Ziegler for the majority and Justice Abramson in dissenting? Rick, you want to go first?
The only thing that surprised me is that it wasn't longer. The outcome did not surprise me. It was really signaled by the Seventh Circuit's decision in a case called Wisconsin Right to Life versus Barlin II a year earlier. I don't think it was a particularly hard case, and it came out just about the way that I thought it would.
Okay. Mike?
To me, it's you're right. Especially with the justices, how long they took to write it. You knew that they were writing a lot of different opinions. In this one, I think every justice wrote an opinion. Is there any justice that didn't write an opinion in it?
Rogensack
was the only one who kept her pen to herself. But it was that there was more. One thing that surprised me is that there was agreement on the issues, the John Doe issues, maybe not on the campaign finance, but that the justices did come together on some of the issues.
Don?
I was a bit surprised by the John Doe part of it, but the campaign finance aspect of the opinion, which to me was the most important given what I do anyway, didn't surprise me at all. I think for the reasons already expressed, but also because if you look at the history of campaign finance adjudication and where sort of libertarian slash conservatives have gone over the years, and where liberals have gone, these opinions really reflect those two different worldviews on both the law and the implication of these kinds of laws.
Well, let's get in first to the impact on future John Doe probes. And let's start with a quote from Justice Gableman, writing for the majority, "Freedom of speech, especially political speech, is the right most fundamental to our democracy. Issue advocacy is afforded greater protection under the First Amendment. We ensure that all issue advocacy will be unencumbered." First of all, let's start with the definition, issue versus express. Mike, you've worked on this for a few years.
Right. What the court has done in this first time this issue came before them was in 1999 with the WMC litigation. And what they avoided doing in that case is they punted it back to the state regulator and to the state legislature, saying, if you want to come up with a description of what express advocacy, issue advocacy, a distinction and regulation in this area, you need to do it more clearly because speakers don't have notice. And so what this court does is say very clearly that what is regulated under Chapter 11 is express advocacy and its functional equivalent, and what isn't regulated as political speech is issue advocacy, and express advocacy being those communications that expressly advocate for the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate.
And that's so we're talking here about these ads that say, call Speaker Voss and tell him thank you for voting for the Milwaukee Bucks.
No, that's issue advocacy.
Okay, I've got it turned around. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
Okay.
The United States Supreme Court has defined it in the negative. They have said that something is issue advocacy unless it is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than a express call to elect or defeat a candidate, which means that it's not hard to frame a message as issue advocacy.
Right. It puts the burden of proof on those who claim that it's express advocacy.
How has this evolved, the difference between issue and express?
I mean, in a way, the U.S. Supreme Court gave us this distinction in 1976, and we've carried it forward to this day.
Is that Buckley versus Willett?
Buckley, in the Buckley decision. So it hasn't evolved as much as the express advocacy, issue advocacy definition, the way that Rick just explained it, has been there since 1976. I think what we've seen is how it plays out in different areas of regulation and what falls within or without campaign finance regulation.
Okay. So, in terms of campaign finance going forward, here's what Justice Gableman said about Section 1101, Parent 16, Wisconsin campaign finance law regulating what influences, that's a key word, an election. Quote, is so broad that every candidate and every campaign in which an issue advocacy group participates would get their own John Doe. This is not and cannot be the law in a democracy. Were you surprised at him, that emphatic language, Don?
Well, that tends to be how conservatives and libertarians have interpreted how these terms can be applied over the last few years. They're elastic, and there was a real suspicion that came out of his opinion, which is not inconsistent with people of his ilk, of bureaucratic interpretation. He talked about the labyrinth of the law and how they put in the hands of bureaucrats to have to apply. There's a deep suspicion on that side of the legal divide over that kind of regulation, in particular in this area. So that's the main concern, is that you're putting the decision as to who can spend money on campaigns into the hands of bureaucrats who are dealing with terms that are fairly elastic.
Yeah. I think that there's a tradition really among justices of a variety of ideological bents that when you're talking about free speech and free association, that it's very, very important that the law be narrowly drawn and very, very clear so that speakers know what is permitted and is not permitted, so that protected, constitutionally protected activity doesn't get deterred. And I think that the problem here is that everybody has understood for years now that the definition of a political purpose, which is the thing upon which Wisconsin's campaign finance law turns, for something to be regulated, essentially it has to be done for a political purpose. Everybody has known for years that the definition in the statute is unconstitutionally broad. And I think that once you accept that, what happened here is not surprising. It's been signaled for a long time. The GAB has sometimes conceded that the definition is overly broad. Sometimes they haven't. The Attorney General raised the issue in 2010. The Seventh Circuit raised the issue. You know, the one thing that people should keep in mind here is that every court that has passed upon the merits of the prosecutor's theory in this case has one way or another rejected it. The Wisconsin Supreme Court here was not an outlier. This was something that was eminently predictable and shouldn't have surprised anyone.
And I couldn't agree more with that, given the outcome in 1999 in the WMC decisions, the cases that happened after that. Any time that someone has tried to leave discretion for someone to decide what to regulate at a later date, you know that you're going to have a problem with that. And I think that's where, back to your very first question today, of was something about this surprising? It shouldn't be. If you had taken the time to look at the cases, if the GAB had taken the time to realize where is it over history that it's been smacked back into place, it's when they don't give that predictability as to what's going to be regulated and what isn't.
And it should be stressed that when it comes to political speech, and as Gableman pointed out, elections are the essence of political speech, that the court's radar is even more intense, and especially when it comes to overbreadth and vagueness doctrine. So that's not unusual. But then again, you look at Abramson's dissent on the First Amendment aspect of the case.
Yes,
she's much more lenient toward these matters.
Right. Well, writing on page 43, Justice Gableman said, "It is left to the whim of each regulatory bureaucrat and our prosecutor to subjectively determine how much coordination is too much." Had it gotten that bad, Mike?
Well, I think what Gableman's point is that if you took the interpretation that was presented to the court in this situation under this scenario that the was presented to them that they were investigating, yes, it would lead to that. I think if you look at coordination complaints generally and how they historically have been dealt with the GAB, it's very easy for anyone to allege coordination. I mean, you see two people having coffee together and you say, oh my God, they must have been talking about something that they shouldn't have been. You file a complaint and then you have to deal with it. And you know, for those of us who advise groups every day, you're always talking to your clients about the fact that it's very easy to allege coordination. And then what you have to do is you have to sit down with the regulator and talk to them about what is it that how is it that you weren't coordinating? So that discretion is always going to be there with a state regulator. You're always going to have to deal with it. But what you shouldn't have to deal with is whether or not the speech, the activity that you were engaged in was also subjecting you to regulation. And that's where the uncertainty, I think, in this particular investigation clouded things greatly.
Is this ruling going to have a chilling effect on future John Does? When Gableman writes on page 34, Special Prosecutor Francis Schmitz, excuse me, his goal was, quote, silence those with whom they, meaning local prosecutors, disagree. Is it going to have a chilling effect on future John Does?
Well, it should, because...
But just narrowly in the area...
Yes, part of the problem here is that you had... coordination investigations are inherently intrusive because you're looking for something that has been hidden, and it could be anywhere, so it justifies a prosecutor looking everywhere. The problem here was exacerbated by the way in which these prosecutors went about doing this. It wasn't a regulatory investigation. They went into people's homes in pre-dawn hours and executed search warrants. They did it broadly. They attacked almost the entire conservative infrastructure of the state of Wisconsin. It amazes me that somebody in their ranks didn't stop and think that this is awful. This is going to look awful. And so the problem is with a coordination investigation is that the law has to clearly define both the content of communications that can be considered coordinated and the conduct that constitutes coordination, because speakers have the right to interact with candidates for elected offices. Not, you know, there's the risk of deterring constitutionally protected activity here. And right now, we don't have a law in the state of Wisconsin that accomplishes either one of those things adequately. And so it in my mind, is not the job of a prosecutor to aggressively dream up or aggressively pursue, you know, legal theories about what might possibly be coordination but isn't clearly coordination. A prosecutor ought to err on the side of allowing constitutionally protected activity to go forward, and one of the problems here is that they didn't do that.
I mean, it certainly will have a deterrent effect on this type of issue.
A campaign finance investigation.
Yes, and I want to also argue beyond that, you look at Ziegler's concurring opinion, which you talked about the Fourth Amendment aspect, which yes. I know is controversial because it wasn't presented before the court.
Right.
But she raised a lot of important questions about Fourth Amendment law.
And she noted
that at least a normative, at stake normatively in the case.
On page 19, she says she noted this was not a drug or a human trafficking investigation.
That's right. I mean,
excuse me for
that. I know of, and I ask my panelists of any example you know of in the past where someone engaged in campaign finance activity has posed a physical danger to somebody else. And generally, when it comes to more aggressive techniques here, no knocks, et cetera, you have to have some proof of that before you are able to engage in that kind of activity. I mean, assuming that these allegations were true, and I know we haven't heard the whole story, this was really an alarming thing, and it surprises me that more people didn't speak out about it.
See, and that's where, to your question about what does it do to future enforcement actions,
yes.
is that, you know, if you look at the decision on its face, I mean, two parts of a three-part decision upheld the John Doe process. So when you think of, you know, the John Doe process, it has a much greater ramification beyond the political speech area, you know, and everyday crimes that prosecutors are looking at and things like that. This process remained intact, and the court upheld it on both of the challenges to that. Mm-hmm. When you look at it for its use in the political context, you know, and I think hopefully this is a lesson that's been learned by regulators across the country is right. These are different crimes. These are not right. bodily harm crimes. These are not, you know, these are individuals who are engaging in that most inherent right of political association and involvement. And you as a prosecutor, you as an investigator should hesitate before you start using tools that you may use in another sort of context and thinking that you can do it here without a much greater burden of proving that there's some sort of wrongdoing.
So the harm is that it was heavy-handed, plus it was so expansive, given the nature of the issue,
yes.
That they were going after. It's also somewhat ironic that John Doe was set up how many decades ago in order to try to prevent this kind of thing from happening, to
yes.
protect the rights of individuals.
Right.
But then given, it's almost like a perfect storm arose in this case.
In fact.
And that got out of hand.
Well, Justice Gableman writing on page 53, John Does, when conducted appropriately, provide much greater protections to the target of an investigation.
Right.
He said they have a long and distinguished service in Wisconsin. Now I want to ask you about Justice Shirley Abrahams' dissent. This decision has far-reaching implications for the state's electoral process, future John Doe proceedings and criminal proceedings generally, the John Doe investigation should not be terminated. This kind of goes back to what I think you both of you just said, right? That this is Shirley's warning of reaction to it.
See, I think she's talking more about the campaign finance aspect
right.
of it. I don't think she's talking about the John Doe process. I think what she's referencing there is the first part of the three-part decision that the majority issued. And okay. I think what she's saying is, and I disagree with her interpretation of that majority opinion, but what she's saying is it has a much broader implication on how activities are going to be conducted on a day-to-day basis. And when you read through Justice Gableman's decision, he watched his words very carefully, I think, to avoid the broad sort of conclusions that she reaches in her dissent.
Well, now let's turn to the impact, the result of the John Doe ruling by the court on campaign finance. And I'm going to use two words from Shirley's dissent, quote, anything goes in campaign finance. Is that, Mike, you're shaking your head? No. Why?
Completely disagree with that.
Okay, why?
Well, because it is anyone who engages in the independent activities has to think about all kinds of different rules. When you engage in political activities, you have to think of how else I may be subjecting myself to regulation if I start interacting with a candidate. You know, it is the example that I give time and again is that a photocopier does not have a political purpose inherently. But if a candidate comes to you and says, buy a photocopier for my campaign so I can put off flyers, mm-hmm. that action in and of itself, setting aside whether it's issue advocacy, express advocacy, whatever it may be, that action by a regulated individual
yes.
begins to have implications. So for those people who interact with, because I always say there are three ways that you step into campaign finance regulation. You step in because you decide to become a candidate or you form an entity. You engage in political speech or you make a contribution. Justice Gableman, what he does a very good job of is talking about that political speech ramification, and that we are not going to allow political speech that doesn't rise to express advocacy to be regulated under Chapter 11. You still have an aspect of it that deals with people who step into that regulation that have a whole set of rules that apply to them. And so for Justice Abramson to say that anything goes, I think that's wrong. I think she's also ignoring the tax code. The tax code has implications for all kinds of reasons on whether or not you should interact with candidates. So for those people who read this decision as sort of a Wild West, I can come up with about 6 to 10 reasons why you still want to stay far away from candidates.
Okay. Rick and Don, on the Justice Abramson's turn, anything
goes?
One point
that she made that is at least worth considering is, you know, the Supreme Court, and correct me if I miss this, but has not directly dealt with the question of whether or not significant coordination within issue advocacy is protected speech. I see the trend in that direction. My guess is that if the case went to the Supreme Court, they would probably go that way. But I think she's right that it hasn't been firmly nailed down by the Supreme Court. So that would be a grounds for a First Amendment appeal.
Rick, on Shirley's term, anything goes?
Yeah, anything doesn't go. And part of the problem here is the way in which state law was structured. Mm-hmm. It was passed before, you know, Buckley versus Valeo is sort of the beginning of the modern era of campaign finance jurisprudence. The decision was 1976. This law, in its essential forms, predates Buckley. It was passed, you know, when I was in high school, if you can believe that. And so the legislature has to go back, I think, now and revisit Chapter 11 because large swaths of it have been declared unconstitutional, not just in this case, but in a variety of other cases. And I think it would be very, very difficult, reading the decision in the John Doe cases, for the legislature to decide that they were going to restrict expenditures, even coordinated expenditures for issue advocacy. Maybe you could do it, I'm not sure. You could probably impose some disclosure requirements, but part of the reason that we have these holes in the law now is because of the way that the law was structured and its inconsistency with the way that the constitutional doctrine has developed in the last 40 years.
Well, that was, actually, you must have been reading my notes, Rick, because that was my next question. What should the governor and legislature do in the wake of the John Doe ruling and also the federal cases? You mentioned the Seventh Circuit and Citizens United, things like that. What issues face, what policy decisions face the governor and the ledge in this area?
One of the things that Rick has already pointed out is the decision doesn't address what is coordination. I mean, it stopped short of even talking about what a coordination standard is, and we don't have that in statute in Wisconsin. So that's one thing the legislature can deal with, and on that content and conduct prong.
Okay. Don, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's basically right, and they could address the disclosure issue as well and expand it as long as it's consistent with the First Amendment. Now, disclosure can go both ways, and sometimes it informs the public. I know when it comes to contributions and expenditures by corporations, there's a lot of public blowback. You know, corporations sometimes will feel the sting of public outrage over their positions on things, as we've seen since Citizens United. But sometimes disclosures can lead to bullying of people as well. Maybe I'd love to see them find a balance when it comes to that. You know, the need for public disclosure, democratic accountability, but also prevention of people, you know, losing their jobs over having given $25 to some group or something like that.
Traveling with this issue in the Capitol is now restructuring or blowing up the GAB. I'm going to ask you three gentlemen. Has the GAB, which was set up in 2008, has it generally worked, Rick?
I think there are problems with the GAB. I think that the notion was that, you know, what we used to have before is we had sort of a regulatory process of mutually assured destruction, where you had partisans on both sides of the fence. They had more or less equal power, and they had to get along with one another. But, you know, sometimes they might get together and sort of serve common partisan interests. So the idea now is that you have a group of retired judges who will act impartially. The difficulty with that is that they're retired, they're part-time, and they're judges. And judges are used to acting upon information that is brought to them by somebody else. They don't seek it out. And so the problem there is that there's the potential then for the board to become staff captive. And if the staff has certain confirmation biases, I don't suggest that they're, you know, Machiavellian and out there sort of scheming to do things, but they exist in a certain environment where they assume that certain things are this way and not that way, that you have the ability, I think, of the board to act in ways which I think some people have perceived as partisan, where I don't think they actually intended to be partisan. But so I think that one of the things to look at is reforming the GAB in a way which inserts some measure of partisan balance and input that maybe doesn't exist now. Obviously, people can go before the board and make arguments, and while perhaps not going all the way back to the old election board.
Mike, your thoughts?
I think where they, for the most part, they've functioned as an agency doing what they need to do with respect to elections, the lobbying regulation that they do. I think that they went off track on campaign finance because that they forgot that their role is to enforce the statutes as been handed to them by the legislature versus reaching for aspirational ways that they think things should be regulated. And I think if they should have learned anything over their existence since 2008 is that, you know, their job is to enforce the law as the legislature enacts it. It's not to decide what they believe reform or regulation should be and should look like in this state. And I think if you look at the setbacks that they've had in the court system, it's generally when they are going beyond their role as an enforcement agency into a policymaking body.
But I cover the old elections board, which you often appeared.
Right.
Is that a better model than GAB?
It was to some extent. I mean, I agree. It had that kind of mutually self-assured destruction aspect to it. But the one thing that it had was the openness. I knew what precedent was being created at the old elections board because decisions were made out in the open. And I know that there's a reason why some of these, the things that they address are done in closed session. But what it does is it leaves everyone into the dark as to how they reach decisions, what they reach them on, what the precedent is for those of us trying to follow the law. Why did they allow this to go? Which creates an inconsistency. When you have precedent in the open there, as that was there with the elections board, you could come in and you could say something, you know, consistent with the way that you decided this in the three past instances, you should decide it this way. It's much, much more difficult to do that with the GAB now.
But, Don, thanks for your patience. The power on the elections board shifted depending on who was in power in the Capitol. Remember, Tom Barrett ran for governor, and the board said, you can use your U.S. House congressional fund. Then the board said, no, you can't.
That was to Congressman Green, who got screwed by the political shift. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Well, sort of reinforces the argument about how, you know, hey, this is a moving target in a way. The law is in evolution right now before our very eyes.
Right.
And kind of the labyrinthine aspect of these questions. It's tough no matter who you are now to know where to draw the right kind of line. And 5 years from now, I think things might be better.
I think, though, that Rick also hit on the other point of staff. And what are the role of the actual board members versus what is the role of staff? And how active should staff be? And how do you create something like this where you have board members that actually take more of a vested interest and more involvement than possibly that they have done historically during the last 5 years?
A couple justices who participated in the John Doe ruling were asked to step aside from it and did not. So you have a conflict on this next question, Mike, so you can participate if you want. Special Prosecutor Francis Schmitz, does he have a good case to make to the U.S. Supreme Court to consider this in the wake of the Caperton 2009 ruling, Caperton versus Massey Cole? Rick?
There are four levels of problems. First of all, it's not clear who has the authority to take an appeal here under state law. It's not clear that he does. Or that he can be paid to do it. Second, it's not clear to me, I think it's an open question, as to whether or not the due process right that the state that was being protected in Caperton, the due process right of a private litigant, can be asserted by the state in a criminal investigation. I don't know that the state has a due process interest in being able to investigate something over against the state court. Third, the Caperton decision, it was a 5-4 decision. The Chief Justice Roberts' dissent said that, you know, this case is going to lead to all sorts of motions to recuse, and Justice Kennedy was very, very stalwart in his majority opinion. He said this is very, very rare, this is very, very unusual, this will hardly ever happen, which has led some people to say that Caperton was a ticket that was good for this day and this train only. There are a number of distinctions between this case and the case in Caperton. The decision here was not pending at the time the expenditures were made. The expenditures were not disproportionate and arguably outcome determinative in the way that they were here. The court in Caperton would not have been disabled from acting as the court here would be if all four justices were required to recuse themselves. And here, the actors that supposedly have an interest are essentially ideological conduits. They're a way in which people who share a political point of view come together and speak. It could be, they could call themselves Club for Growth today, they could call themselves something else. And if you look at the Supreme Court's definitions of what constitutes impermissible judicial bias, being biased in favor of an ideological position isn't one of them. And so, in a way, you have the problem here that the prosecutors come in and they ask for the conservative justices to recuse themselves because they've targeted virtually every conservative organization in the state. They're trying to turn the sin of the scattershot approach that they took into a sword. It reminds me a little bit of the guy who kills his parents and then pleads for clemency because he's an orphan. And so I don't think that they're going to be successful. Plus, you've got all sorts of procedural problems with a cert petition. It's not clear that, say, the Supreme Court reverses in this case. Under all the possible scenarios that I've been imagined, it doesn't change the outcome in this case. If they require Justices Prosser and Gabelton to recuse themselves, it's still 3-1 to deny the supervisory writ, and the subpoenas and warrants are still quashed. So I really don't think that there's any way to resurrect this on the part of the prosecutors.
Any PS on that? No?
Well, just a little bit. I mean, I think the point about how the outcome would stay the same obviously matters, as well as everything else has been mentioned. You know, the political background of this and the recusal rules that the Supreme Court here took on, and the politics of that, I think, are open to question, and depending on your position on it. But that's not necessarily going to work itself into the legal case.
Okay, thank you. Maybe final question for each of you. If you were testifying before the Joint Committee of the Senate and the Assembly on elections. And you were asked, in the wake of the John Doe ruling, what should we do as legislators? Your advice to them? Donnie, you want to go first?
Well, you're asking a more general question.
More general.
Yeah. I mean, I have always thought that, you know, there's a trade-off between all the money out there now, and concerns about that are really affecting our democracy. I mean, you look at the populism rising on both the right and the left. A lot of that has to do with the concern people have. The system is no longer, we no longer have much input into the system. So I think that's an important political and normative issue. On the other hand, when you empower a bureaucracy to make these kinds of decisions that can interfere with elections, and you look at some of the previous cases, going back to the Citizens United, where the Solicitor General said that, had they even published a book about Hillary Clinton, that could have been prohibited under the rules in that case. To me, it's a tragic kind of trade-off. Money in politics, which is having a huge impact in terms of the mentality people have about democracy, compared to, you know, a kind of a Rube Goldberg kind of bureaucratic system, which can stifle speech. Pick your poison. Mm-hmm. I'm more libertarian, so I know which direction I will lean in. But I think that is a trade-off.
Mike, your thoughts if you were testifying?
I think the key thing that they need to do is improve the ability of the average candidate or contributor or speaker to understand Chapter 11. Instead of trying to tackle, you know, big picture reforms, just go back to what you have now on the statutes and clean it up so it's readable, and so that you don't have people like Justice Gableman or the Seventh Circuit saying, we can't even understand what's in your statutes regulating campaign finance.
Dan Rick?
When we talk about money in politics, I would first observe that we spend a lot less money promoting candidates than we do selling beer. And if you look at the history of campaign finance reform, it is just one long series of unintended consequences after another, and it's an exercise in futility. I wrote an article a couple years back where I stole a line from a guy with attribution that the history of campaign finance has been like playing a game of whack-a-mole with an endless supply of moles. And so I think the legislature needs to be humble about what can be accomplished. It needs to focus on disclosure rather than restriction. But it also has to keep in mind, because I think Don made an extremely important point, that disclosure cannot be allowed to become a vehicle for retaliation and turning politics into total war. So what I say to activists all the time is, if you want disclosure, and I say this particularly when I'm sitting here in Dane County, if you want disclosure, then stop calling for boycotts and retaliation against people who take political positions that you disagree with, because that raises constitutional concerns, and that makes people like me, who might otherwise be favorably disposed towards it, to be not so favorably disposed.
Quick response to that?
Quick.
I mean, I think maybe one of the dilemmas is that, you go back to the McCutcheon case last year or the year before, that disclosure is an antidote to allowing a lot more money into politics. So when you have a dilemma with disclosure, then you've sort of compounded the dilemma.
Any PS there, Rick? Or?
Nope,
we're
I
done?
Agree.
Okay. Wonderful discussion of a fascinating ruling. I want to thank Rick Essenberg, Mike Wittenweiler, and Donald Downs for helping us sort through the Supreme Court's John Doe decision. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
You.